Radio Real. Real radio, your reality. Welcome to Voices in the Machine, the adventures and discussions of a group of steampunk pioneers making their way across two frontiers, the actual 21st century and the virtual world of Second Life.
Hello, this is Voices in the Machine for October the 31st, 2008.
Hello, everybody. This is Gabrielle Real, recording the first ever official podcast for Radio Real. Welcome to Voices in the Machine. And this is a bit of an experiment. I've pulled together three fellow travelers from the virtual world of Second Life. We all live in a virtual steampunk Victorian world, and we're going to be talking about steampunk topics and topics that are pertinent to the virtual communities that we live in. So I would like to introduce the hosts who are going to be working with me on this show. So good evening or good morning, Edward Pierce.
Good morning.
And also with us is our pixie extraordinaire, Fuchsia Begonia.
Hello!
Hello, hello. And the final cast member is Mr. Nick Sands.
Greetings, all.
I've been wanting to do a podcast. Well, I've been wanting to do a podcast in general for 3 years. And I've wanted to do one with the Victorian steampunk people for two in Second Life. So, but speaking of Second Life, and before we get into the meat of the show today, I want to talk to you guys, or actually, I'm going to make you guys talk and tell our audience about who you are and what you do in Second Life and how you came to Second Life, and feel free to tell us all the dirt.
Hey.
So I'm going to put Edward on the spot first. Tell us about yourself.
Well, Edward, he says, devolving into third person, Edward is a Scottish-based... Actually, I'll go at it from this way. Edward Pierce was a concept that when I came to Second Life, I already had the setup going for a steampunk character. Or steampunk avatar. The name Edward Pierce has stolen considerable amounts from Sean Connery.
No.
Yes. Edward Pierce is actually the name of a character he plays.
Train robbery. Called
The Great Train Robbery, yes.
Bingo.
And the moustache and facial hair is stolen from Sean Connery's Sergeant Dravot from The Man Who Would Be King. So he already had the Sean Connery influence, so that gave him the Scottish background, and although most people don't hear a Scottish accent when you're typing, it's there. Although probably more of an Ian Richardson Scottish than a Billy Connolly Scottish. He's essentially come to Caledon, started out as a humble tailor, who saw a need for menswear, Victorian menswear at least. At the time, there were literally hundreds of shops that would sell you anything for women and everything, but there wasn't a lot of menswear stuff. And having a large collection of costume photos and various things like that, I took it upon myself to learn Photoshop at a very self-taught manner, and set up a tailoring business in Second Life selling Victoriana inspired clothing. That since then, Edward has virtually taken on a life of his own. He's now married. He has his own duchy. He's been involved in wars, and as a result of a role-playing incident, he ended up with a steampunk arm, And that's something that's just been kept with the character.
And isn't it true that Mrs. Salordi, sir, actually uses it to do the washing?
Well, thank you, Sir Lordy, sir, as Fuchsia calls you, or my dear Duke, as I now call you. Okay, Miss Pixie, tell us about how the Pixie came to be.
Oh, well, I never was very much good at geography, you know. If you see my school report, it's terrible. And I sort of went for a walk one day and got lost and sort of not just in the wrong place but at the wrong height and sort of fell out of the sky and landed on my then-not-husband, Alfonso, who happened to be partying on a beach with a certain disreputable Time Lord, Ulon Sputnik. And they were very nice about it and, if you land on a chap, you kind of have to marry him. And we, set up a circus. Behaved. Honestly, what are you people like? Ulon's this big explorer, and he'd basically found Caladan. And he told us about it, and we thought, well, you know, it sounds like a good place to land a circus, and only we didn't. We had a colony on the mainland, the first official Caledonian colony.
Yes, that was a big deal.
It was, yes, and it's still there. The cannon doesn't work anymore, unfortunately, but the tent's still there, and the tent, or both tents, the flying one and the normal one. And then, actually, pretty much this time last year, I actually asked the governor for a little bit of earth in Caledon, and that was when we got our place halfway up the mountain in Welsian. And basically, because I'm a weird size and height and shape, most of the costumes I ever bought never fit. So, you know, Terry Lightfoot was experimenting with things. And, you know, no show without punch, so I had a go as well. And, you know, various people said, there's not enough menswear, so can you do some of that too? And the rest is history, and lots of silly parties. We do good silly parties.
Okay, Mr. Nix Sands. When did you come to Caledon?
I think about a year ago, April, I think it was. I came to Caledon fairly soon after I started Second Life. I think I hung around in Tombstone for a couple of weeks. I met someone there who just about ran me down with her horse, and she hired me to make a house for her. That was the first Second Life building I think I did. The first costuming I did, I was walking around this western town and didn't see any. Everybody had pretty straightforward characters, and I wanted to do something different. So I made myself a Chinese coolie outfit. It wasn't very good and didn't really have developed skills as far as working within Second Life, but that was the fateful costume I was wearing when I was run down by the horse. I think, I don't know what I was looking for, but I came to Caledon. I think the same person that ran me down with the horse decided she needed a house in Caledon. And so I built the house for her in Ayr. I started getting interested in trying to have some land in Caledon, and I got put on, I think, one of the group talk channels. Slowly got acquainted with people that were in Caledon and businesses and goings on and things like that. So that's how I came to Caledon. I first started building airships in Second Life. That was the thing that thrilled me the most. And I wanted to do business. And I started to look at what there were lots of and what there were few things of. And the thing that was the scarcity, as everybody said so far, was men's clothes. And I've got a costume background. I've made Victorian clothes. I've made costumes of all kind, collected costumes of all kind. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. I think I'll try that. I was lucky in that I had a Photoshop background from, 20, 25 years of being a graphic designer. So that's the easy part. Trying to wrap textures onto Second Life avatars is fraught with peril and headaches and all the rest.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I'm sure we can all agree with that one.
And
I was very inspired by people like you, Edward, and you, Fuchsia, that with the things that you made. And I thought, gee, I'd love to make Victorian men's clothes, but it's kind of been done. The people that are doing it are doing the best that I've seen or the best I can imagine. And so I decided to do a different take on it. I decided, why don't I just make them really loud and impossibly garish with plaids and paisleys and things like that. And so I started to go from that angle. And that's sort of what led me to the point I'm at today. I haven't really revealed that to my public, in that the selling the clothes as separates has made people sort of put them together in not very dynamic.
And creative.
Tasteful. Yeah, no. You're looking for the word is tasteful.
Yeah, they're more tasteful than adventurous, I suppose. So I'm launching into my second phase now, where I'm going to introduce them to the madness that is my brain. That is my concept for Victorian clothing.
Oh, you do used to do some cracking waistcoats.
Yeah, they're easy and you can do them quickly. And I was hoping to induce people to buy lots of them and change them often, so that.
Oh, come on. The men in Caledon have one outfit and one outfit only. And it's like, you know, I just get these pictures of, you know, how old Wild West films where they're sewn into their underwear. And that's the kind of vision I have of most of the men in Caledon. They're sewn into those outfits. And I just don't know how we get most of them out of them.
Well, they're usually...
Oh, that came out really badly, didn't it? I didn't mean that.
I'm going to rescue this tangent by introducing myself. Gabrielle Real came to Second Life with a wave of real-life podcasters. I ended up meeting a lot of my real-life podcast heroes inside of Second Life. I did work briefly for Podshow, Adam Curry's podcasting company. But while I was working for them, and I was their party planner, I'm sure you'll all be shocked to hear.
Oh, yes.
I can't remember. Oh, I found Caledon. I stumbled across Caledon, and I've always, my entire life, been interested in the Victorian era. When I saw it, I immediately knew, I have to live here. And Caledon was still a new nation, and it was one of the only estates that had a Victorian theme at the time. I remember getting into a discussion with Desmond at some point about voids, or what are now known as open space sims, and I had one at the time in Dreamland, and I used it just to build and terraform and to learn. It was my learning. It was where I kind of did all my learning. And Desmond said, oh, you know, I'm thinking about bringing these voids into Caledon. You know, what do you think about that? And I said, oh, I think it'd be great. You know, I have one right now. It's wonderful. I use it, you know, to play. And he said, well, would you be interested in one if I brought them to Caledon? And I said, oh, yeah, sure. Because I thought I would just move my little sandbox closer to where my actual home was. And without realizing it, Desmond started a whole other side to Caledon when he rolled out the first four voids and decided to call the people that rented them duchesses. And it just so happened that it was all women. And all of a sudden, I was a duchess.
All hail your DJ-ness.
And I've been one ever since. And simultaneously to becoming a duchess, I'd always known I wanted to DJ in Second Life. And I started doing it. And the response that I got was just so overwhelming. And I was shocked. And I had people like Edward and Red Caliber and others approach me and say, oh, hey, I've done DJing, you know, at clubs. I've done DJing for parties. I've done DJing on the radio. You know, can I work with you? So it was just kind of like all these people showed up at my doorstep and said, hi, let's work together. And all of a sudden, I had a radio station in Second Life. So,
you mean all the lunatics found you?
They did. So that's, yeah, it's been quite the ride. And now here we are. Mm-hmm. Voices in the Machine. One of the things that we are going to do every week, hopefully, if we can get people to work with us on Voices in the Machine, is have someone come in that we can interview. And this is anyone from Second Life, anyone who's done anything interesting in Second Life. Of course, we want to get to know more people from the Victorian steampunk and other themed areas. But for our first interview, we're bringing in the Viceren of the independent state of Caladan, Dez's right-hand woman from pretty much the beginning, her Leoness, Camilla Hoffman. Welcome to the inaugural Voices in the Machine podcast, and thank you for doing this on such short notice.
Well, we got through. It was a little bit crazy setting up, but I managed to get Skype and my microphone to quit fighting.
Yay!
Woohoo!
Been there, done that.
Yeah.
I was such a noob. So glad to be here.
Oh, we've all gone quiet because we're so shy.
Originally, Camilla, at least in its original seed, was made as a joke for a Star Trek AOL chat room. Now, the unlike Desmond,
so many levels.
unlike Desmond, the captain of that particular simulation was he couldn't admit his catgirl fascination, so I made up this joke to prank him with it, and the character actually stuck and was there for a few years in that simulator before we jumped onto Second Life. Actually, Second Life pretty much killed that simulation because we all moved on to Second Life, and I probably could have been within the Second Life community in late 2003, early 2004. That's when I started hearing about it, but to me it sounded like another MMO or a World of Warcraft. You kill something, get points. I never really understood that unless you're sitting across the table from the people you're playing with, swilling some beer and cracking bad jokes and rolling dice. So I didn't catch on to Second Life until much, much later, and besides, I couldn't afford the video card at the time. And until late 2005, various other simulators had fallen apart. I was in a particularly foul place at work with various drama rolling around, and it became it seemed like an interesting escape to me. So I signed on, and very shortly my significant other jumped on it too, and we were fighting over our solitary computer regularly just to get online.
Oh, that sounds really familiar.
I found out that after about a week of this that I hadn't missed a day. So I bought 20 Linden dollars and registered my account. And it's been registered as a premium ever since because, this is a quick way to get a little bit of money as it rolls in. $20 worth of thing, outfitted my avatar just nicely. I've settled on a Luskwood White Lioness. I do have a male online identification, but that's used for completely different purposes. I was using that for proofreading various bits of fiction. But Cammy, I brought onto the grid, had gone through various incarnations since this Star Trek role-playing simulator. I immediately started digging around for Victoriana because I live in a city that has a great deal of influence with the architecture, and maybe it's just a function of being Canadian. I've been steeped in the monarchy all my life, and I picked out ballroom gowns, and I... Then I met Yuriko Muromachi, who is pretty much the only specialty Victoriana maker at the time that I liked.
Yes, there were very few people creating Victorian fashions in general, and Yuriko was really one of the first and one of the best.
Well, there were others, but they were a little bit too shiny and happy for my tastes. So Yuriko's, the original first one I bought was, I believe she still sells it. It was the Morning Glory, a very gothic sort of thing. And since Camilla always was a tall, imposing type, it worked well. And I carried on with that, just chumming around with Yuriko, because I took her dresses to galas. And I would say, hey, I won another contest for Best Dressed Avatar. And she was... getting a shop made by Desmond Chang when he was just in the middle of his West Trade heyday.
God, he gets everywhere, that guy.
Well, this was pre-Caladon. Now, one of the triggers for Caladon was Yuriko saying to Desmond, I'll make more dresses if you make a sim for me to sell them in, because Neo Victoria had just about died at that time. Moved into the Caledon sim, tagging along with Yuriko. It grew, Caledon 2 came in, and then various societies started growing. Highlands didn't have much of a societal impact. It was basically people who desperately wanted into Caledon's overflow refuge, and I believe Lynn moved in at that time, too. Then Port Caledon, I moved in there. At that point, Desmond asked me to take over the steward mantle, to be the estate manager. After that, we took on Tamarnock and Caledon on Sea, and nobody else wanted to be the steward, because it really could be a real stinky job.
A real pain to wander around.
Should we explain what a steward is for those who may not know?
Yeah.
An estate manager. It's a glorified janitorial position.
I was going
to say. Take out trash of all types, prims or people.
Yeah. Aisle 7.
Picking stuff up. One of the things that we're going to do every other week when we do this podcast is discuss news or current events that are going on either in the communities that we're involved in or also, you know, Second Life in general. Sometimes there's, you know, overarching concepts that come up in the news that affect everybody, which is what we're going to talk about this week. Yes. We're recording this on Halloween night. It's October 31st. Well, it's November 1st for Edward. And actually, it's, well, no, not yet for Fuchsia, but...
No, still 40 minutes before I turn into a pumpkin.
Yep. But the big thing that rolled out this week, rolled out Monday evening, the 27th, at 6 o'clock-ish, Second Life time, was a change in policy and pricing to the open space sims in Second Life. Open spaces, also known as void sims. And it has been a massive firestorm, a massive controversy. And we kind of want to summarize it here and discuss it a little bit so that we can help educate our listeners about what it all means, what's gone on thus far, you know, how much information is out there. There's a lot of misinformation out there as well. So we're going to talk about that and see if we can get
to it.
A little clarity. I'm going to summarize the changes. What they were planning on doing, they were going to, well, they are, as of right now, as of January 1st, 2009, they are going to increase the monthly maintenance fee on Open Space Sims from $75 US per month to $125 US per month.
Wow.
It's a 66% increase. They're also increasing any upfront fee for someone who's ordering an open space sim new from $250 US to $375 US. So that's adding on a significant amount as well. They've also ushered in some other really draconian measures. They're no longer going to allow the owner of an open space to be changed to a different resident than the payer. And we'll talk a little bit about what's an owner versus a payer during our discussion. They're not going to offer a nonprofit discount for nonprofits or educational institutions on open spaces anymore. So they're going to have to pay full pop.
Ooh.
They're making changes to the viewer that enables residents to know what type of land or region they're on. And then they're also going to talk to people who are in current open spaces that are abusing them in terms of use or overuse. And we're going to have to talk a little bit about what that could mean, because as of right now, abuse has not yet been defined by them. We've got some major...
official definitions of light use at this point.
Yeah. Mm. We've got some major changes. Now, for those people who don't know, an open space sim, I'm just going to define open space sim right here, because some people aren't familiar with what they are. There's sims that are meant to be open spaces, used as, like, forests, fields, open water for sailing. They're meant to be used almost as connectors between standard sims, but they kind of help flesh out, I guess, the environment a little bit, you know, so it's not just a bunch of housing or little towns all stacked right on top of each other. It gives, well, it's open space between all the residences. When I got my open space sim 2 years ago, it had only 1,875 prims available in the entire sim. Now, normally in a standard sim, you get around 16,000 or just under 16,000 prims. So, I mean, you can see them.
15,000, exactly.
I mean, it's a major difference.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. Just much bigger than I thought it was.
Yeah, 16,000 versus, you know, almost 2,000. About 6 months ago, and Cammy, you can probably help me define this a little bit better. About 6 months ago, they doubled those prims in open space sims. Yeah, it was about 6 months ago.
I've done research, and I've got March. All the blog tabs sitting right here.
When was it?
It was March.
It was March that they doubled the prims in open space sims to 3,750. I had lived with an open space sim for a year and a half, running it in a very lean manner because we had, you know, so little prims available, and I was always very careful. So getting those prims doubled was like, I was like a kid in a candy shop, because all of a sudden I had all these prims that I could, I can actually live in my sim now. So that's what an open space sim is. Whereas you have one full standard sim per CPU or per processor on a server, you get four open space sims per processor on a server. So bringing up the prims to 3750 actually was a nice kind of equalizing. They were actually bringing up the amount of prims to a true quarter of what would be a full sim. Mm-hmm. And if you've got four open spaces on one processor, then so that's your quarter. This has sent a lot of people into major tailspins.
Oh, that's putting it nicely.
Yeah.
You're speaking, of course, of the price hike is what we're talking about.
Correct.
Not the prim allowance, but no, huge increase.
Yeah, 66%.
The other thing to note, that in addition to in March when they upped the prim count, they also made quite significant changes to the way open space sims could be accessed. Previously, you had to buy them in lots of four. In order to do that, you had to put it in through a support ticket. So you had to already own a sim, and to get an open space sim, you had to buy them in lots of four. When they changed this, you could now buy them in lots of one. By individual one. Yeah, with those changes, the Linden Labs land store didn't actually say, now you can buy your own sim as for a house, but the fact that they'd now more than doubled, well, just over doubled the prim count for an open space sim, and that they were selling them individually as a cheap alternative to a full sim, lots of people assumed that they were then being promoted as, well, now you can buy, you know, you don't need the prims, but rather than have your single house that has a couple of, you know, 1,000 prims on a tiny little 4096 block of land, and the person next to you's got their 1,000 prims on their 4096, and you end up with the mainland all over again. Now you can actually put some distance between you and your neighbor.
Client side viewer as well. If you're not don't have all these prims packed into the same area, especially with prim saving measures like transparencies on the windows, so that even though you can't see through most of the wall, the occlusion culling does not work. So if we're putting distance between the houses, you'll have a considerable frame rate increase.
Okay, can I be devil's idiot here for a second?
Go for
it. We're talking a lot about owning land. I mean, what does that actually mean in SL, owning land? I mean, do you actually own it or are you renting it?
Why do you want to?
Well, I don't. I'm quite happy with my bit of half a mountain, but, you know.
That's what I'm saying. As a, you know, why would you want to own land in Second Life? Yeah, all that sort of stuff.
Well, owning land, there are several definitions, and it depends on where you live. Does anyone really own anything in Second Life? That's kind of a big philosophical question.
I suppose ultimately everything is owned by Linden Labs, and if they turn around and say, we are shutting down the thing tomorrow, tough bickies, everybody.
Right.
You've got...
Right.
You know, mm-hmm.
But, you know, that reality aside, there were the two options. You could, quote-unquote, buy land on the mainland, and that would be yours and in your name. Or, if you had the cash and the resources, you could order your own private sim or private estate. Now, we live in the independent state of Caledon, which is a private estate owned by and originally ordered by Desmond Chang.
Well, hail the Govna, sir.
Yes. So, Govna is technically the owner. The covenant in Caledon and other reputable communities state very clearly that if anyone comes to those communities and gets a lot there, you're renting.
Yeah.
So we are all ultimately renting.
Yeah, you've effectively bought the leasehold, not the freehold.
Right. Exactly. Those are the two real types. You're going to have the estates that are their own private communities that they've been, servers that were ordered and purchased by Dez and others. Or you could just go start buying up chunks of land on the Linden mainland. And one of the many interesting concepts that this whole price increase and policy change has brought up is the concept of what are you using your open space sim? Not what are you using it for, how are you using it, but what's the word I'm looking for?
Acceptable use?
Yeah, how are you using it in terms of how many prims you put down? How are you using it in terms of how many scripts you're running in that space?
Traffic, avatars.
Traffic, exactly.
I think the word you're looking for is utilization.
Yeah, exactly.
there's another point. Caledon, at the moment, is 44 sims, of which there are 20... Open spaces,
yes.
So now most, I think all bar two of those are individual renters. If the people who are renting those at the moment or people who are the custodians of those at the moment can't afford the price hikes, then that means that either those sims will go or things will have to be changed around. You know, so not only is the possibility that the sim may no longer be there, as an example... The sim that I have as an open space, and so yes, I'm one of the people affected, is Argyle. Now, attached to that are two other sims. So if Argyle goes, that means that then Des has to pay to have those other two sims shifted in because they would no longer be attached to Caledon.
Oh, right.
Yeah, we have actually quite a few reshuffling situations that would have to go on. And I do think that probably the biggest loss to the community would be having the Firth broken up because it's used both by aviators and by sailors very actively. But I want to, I guess, dispel some of the rumors or misinformation. I'm going to mention one and then I'm going to ask Cammy to speak to what she wrote in her blog. One thing that people need to understand is that if you've never heard the term open space or void, then you aren't living on one, most likely. Or if you are, you've been duped by your landlord. You know, a lot of the people that I've spoken to thought that this was going to mean tier hikes across the board for all residents in all estates. That's not the case at all. You own a parcel or renting a parcel of land in a full standard sim, this does not affect you. at all, other than the fact that your neighbors are probably crying their eyes out. But in terms of you seeing a price hike, it's not going to be an issue. And as Edward said, there's 20 open spaces in Caledon. Two of them have maybe 12 residents in them, and then there's the 18 of us. So we're looking at, what, like maybe 30 people out of how many hundreds that are really affected. It's a small group, but it's more about the cohesiveness of the layout of the land, of the community, mm-hmm. that's really going to be disrupted. And then, of course, there are some estates that are built on nothing but open space Sims. They're going to be decimated. But
give me an example of one of those.
I was going to say, I think Antiquity is certainly more than half. I think they've got about two or three full Sims. The rest are voids.
And they have, what, 20, 25
something
Sims?
Like that, yeah. I think so.
Blimey.
You're looking at, 20 Sims being demolished and three remaining. Another community are the Islands of Fatima, who's also a wonderful Victorian community. She has, I don't know, about 12 or 15, and she's like half to three quarters open space Sims.
Oh, so she's got like 24 Sims right now. So mm-hmm. I don't know how many of them are open space, but
She's over half open space. But Antiquity's another one that'll be hit hard as well, because the percentage of the land in their community is more open space Sims.
So were there any rules actually ever set down for these things as to exactly what you could and couldn't use them for? Like really strict ones that were nice and clear? Because I think, certainly from the things I've picked up, one of the complaints is that it's abuse of how they're being used.
Right.
That's the problem.
But
I think that there are guidelines, but that's all they are. The guidelines for OpenSim says that it is for light use, but pedantic bods that we are, nobody has actually said, well, what does light use mean?
What mm-hmm.
And the thing was that even when back in the day when the open spaces were just 1700 prims, they were designed for light use. So when they've upped the prim count to over 3,500. People have assumed, well, obviously, what they were light use, we've now doubled the prims, so that means we can make more use.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm a perfect example, because I never lived in my open space sim. I just kept it more as parkland and then a place to have the manor house with occasional parties, and mm-hmm. I own land in Caledon K. Well, then when they doubled the prims, I said to myself, I really couldn't justify having both my K land and the open space land when then now I had enough prims to live there. So I sold the K land and I actually moved into the open space sim. So I do live there now.
Mm-hmm. So I was chatting about this with Alfonso, my lovely husband there, when I knew we were going to do this as the podcast. And he was sort of commenting, from his scripting perspective, that, well, if you're going to make these things water sims, then just the demands from scripting and the prims on the boat and, if you're going to fly through them, all the scripts and prims to do with that, that's automatically going to punt these things into fairly high usage.
Well, Makes sense. It's probably the thing that, saying that they're to be used as, parkland for sailing and stuff like that, there are no clear definitions or even clear guidelines as to what levels of use and how, it's like with the Caledon Air Force having, they do weekend dogfights. Now, they try and move those around so that they're not always in the same place. But, does having a dogfight over an open space sim, is that going to kill it for the other three sims that are attached on there? There's no way of doing it. And that on the other extreme, as a test, we had managed to get 100 avatars into Kantai to find out whether or not that would crash the server, and it didn't.
Now I feel incredibly guilty about that test.
but that was done That was done with Linden Lab's knowledge and approval, because Des had actually said...
That's true.
He's been asked to try and test the server to see whether or not we can crash it.
That's
we got
true.
100 people into an open space sim, and it didn't crash.
Klaus Wolfenbach Outlander and myself canvassed all of Antiquity, Winterfell, and Caledon looking for matching pairs of simulators, and we would pick one and beat the hell out of it and see what the effect it had on the other. Well, take it back. Edwards covered quite a bit of this. I've got some dates and some actual specifics here. September 21st, 2006, about what is light use? And it says, they are provided for light use only, not for building, living in, renting as homes, or use for events. That was September 21st, 2006. Move on to March 7th, 2007, where they doubled the prim count, as if they didn't know what was going on. See, they adjusted some prices. They were still $415 a pop at the time. Later on, April 2008, where, all right, now they're $250 a pop, mild price adjustment, and you can buy them in singles. Unless there is some sort of a refund clause in here, there were some minor mentions of refunds in the April thing, but it doesn't say whether it extends to current getting your money back for paying for this thing. But I can go over some of the basics here. We did manage to find three matched pairs in Caledon, Winterfell, and Antiquity. Two of them were Nova Civis Caledon and Caledon Glamorgan. I had an interesting problem with that test because it involved a sphere full of 403 physical marbles. Will bring any simulator to its knees, but not crash.
That's just evil.
It's terrible.
Just for a point of reference, the Nova Civis Caledon sim is, for those who may not be familiar, is a sim that's set up. NCI is effectively a newcomers group in Second Life that helps noobs come in and, you know, how do I walk, how do I change my avatar, all that sort of stuff. And they also do a lot of teaching of how to build, how to script, things like that. So NCI does tend to get a fair bit of high use anyway, as far as scripting and things like that goes. So, yeah, that as a testing one would certainly be a very good one to go with.
Well, we had a problem with that because Glamorgan's downhill and no res. So whenever I put
and,
one of
and
physical...
for the Welsh, can I say it's Glamorgan, please?
oh geez.
I was going to correct that, but then I thought we'd get on to things like, you know, Warwickshire and stuff like that.
Come on. Leave the North Americans alone, will you?
Anywho, let me try to get through this thing here. Glamorgan is downhill from Nova Civis. So whenever I put out one of these physics things, there was always a bit of a popcorn effect where the physical marbles would penetrate the wall and they'd roll downhill into... Greystoke and Kintyre, and I tried to clean them up as best I could, but I didn't get very clear results from that, except that there was no appreciable effect on Kintyre or on Greystoke when I put the physics bomb down on, and it took several attempts before Glamorgan seemed to be affected. Now, we managed to confirm that. It took three hits dropping one of these physics bombs in Winterfell, undertow, and while Klaus Wolfenbach was in Antiquity Shoals gauging the results. The first time I put one of those physics things out, there was almost no effect in Antiquity. I deleted the physics balls and put down another one. There was very little effect on Antiquity, but there's a bit of a blip, a bit of a blink. And when I put the third one out, it brought Antiquity to its knees. It's almost as though...
it's like a cumulative
stacking
effect.
It looked like it's almost as though they've oversubscribed these things, as though a cable company would oversubscribe their broadband nodes. It would take... The first hit would be, okay, we'll firewall you back a bit, and then we'll firewall you back again. Oh, and then on the third one... "Oh, right, we'll just let you have everything on the CPU." It's almost like they have a half-built wall between these open space sims. Those were our observations. And so summing up, beating up on an open space simulator, it does beat up the other ones on the same CPU. It seems to have a bit of a cumulative effect. I'd be interested in testing these things again on the beta grid if we can match up any things if we have a sim bashing exercise.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to do with our pilot podcast was to try and educate a little bit about what are the known components of this policy. That's been pretty clear in terms of a general statement. You know, they've generally stated what they're going to do. What we're missing are specific descriptions of what misuse or overuse would be. Things right now are still very much in flux. Nothing of any really substantial note has been mentioned about this policy coming out. Jack sent a follow-up on Wednesday the 29th. Basically, he says, "Thank you so much for giving us feedback." which there are really two places where we're recommending that people go for feedback. One is the JIRA. It's Miscellaneous 1776, which is now, I think, got over how many votes? It's got,
I don't know, something.
It's well over
3,000 votes. There's also a forum post on the Second Life forums that is now up to probably 5 bazillion posts. So he's basically saying, thank you for the feedback, keep it coming. Keep the discussion going on this, but also keep it on topic. And that, I think the thing that upset me the most the day after, that Tuesday when everyone was freaking out, is I understand the need to emotionally vent. But what I saw happening, people were getting into various chats in various communities and just kind of going off very randomly and then ultimately engaging in fights with others in the community.
Rabble rousing.
Yeah.
And there's things like, you know, there's been suggestions of, you know, we should abandon Second Life for a day as a protest. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know that it will really have that much effect.
That would not hurt Linden Labs. All it would hurt is maybe people like yourself who have businesses in Second Life. You'd have a day without sales.
And I don't know whether I'm deluding myself into wishful thinking or whatever, but some of the discussions that I've been seeing and have been having, I'm of the opinion at the moment that this is, if you like, an opening volley that Linden Labs have come out and said, we're going to hike your prices up the bejesus. And then, you know, 3 months from now, they'll come back and go, well, actually, we've listened to your feedback and we will bring it down to, you know, a $50 a month price increase, which is what they were really intending all along.
Yeah.
But
it
by
could
doing
well be
that,
an
they
open gambit.
I mean, certainly the reasoning that they're giving behind the price increase, which, you know, as Cammy said earlier, is this the abuse of the Sims, to me, doesn't gel with, you know, if the Sims are being abused, we therefore need to put the price up. Does not work for me.
Right. And we do have it on good authority that they're not lying when they say that they're experiencing major technical problems due
certainly
to
not
the open space situation. That's true. But I agree with you in that anyone who has any experience in business, and many of us in Second Life have our own businesses in Second Life, have our own businesses in real life, or have worked in the business world in real life in some form or fashion, this is so completely illogical that it's. I think that's part of one of the reasons why people are so upset. There is a big piece of this that's not out in the open yet because it's just so very crazy. We will keep on this. Hopefully this helps explain things a little bit to people. You know, our leader, our governor Desmond Chang, has advised us to just let's sit back, let's wait, let's watch, let's kind of see what happens here, let's be calm, even though we want to kill them. Being very pragmatic about it, and I think that's all we can do right now.
I think the best thing is to, you know, no, there's not really anything that you can do at the moment, but by all means, talk about it.
Yeah,
and out on your blog or the mm-hmm. chat room or the, you know, the thing, and let Linden Labs know what you think about it. But certainly, you know, ranting off and going, you know, all Lindens deserve to die, rah rah rah, not really going to be constructive.
Right, and you can put your vote even in on the JIRA, and I'll have a link to that on our blog, and also post on the forum. So, okay, let's pass it on over to Mr. Nix, who's going to talk about one of the future features that we're going to have on Voices in the Machine.
Voices in the Machine, want to hear what you have to say. Please email us at podcast@radioreel.org. I'm going to spell that for you. It's a radio reel, RIEL.org. And we will arrange to record your reading, your editorial. Or one of the cast will read it if you do not want to have your voice on the air.
Okay, kids. Well, let's wrap this pilot podcast up. We're planning on doing this bi-weekly. We highly appreciate our Vice-Ren making her appearance here on Virtual Voices. And also thank all of you who have chosen to subscribe or download or listen to this on a stream. And the Fearsome Foursome will be back in action in a couple of weeks. And we'll see you then. Voices in the Machine is produced for Radio Reel by Gabrielle Reel and Otenth Paderborn. Copyright 2008. You can find Radio Reel on the web at radioreel.org. All music in this production is from artists on the Magnatune label. The music in the general introduction is John Playford's All in a Garden Green by Eileen Hadivian and Natalie Cox from their album Dolce Musica, A Contemplative Journey. The Voices in the Machine theme music is Cubanola Glide by Professor Armchair on his album Too Much Mustard. You can learn more about Magnatune on their website, magnatune.com.
What's the podcast equivalent of riding off into the sunset?
Dum bottom 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 bottom.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.
Till then, I'm feeling happy.
Maybe I shouldn't
have
asked.
You said herding cats was easy.